I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection, live from Baghdad. We take you to the markets, only just starting to reopen. People in Baghdad are nervous and uncertain. They are themselves ready to venture outside, but slowly and cautiously. One young boy, maybe 13 years old, was shot today standing at his own front door. Other victims, looters, are being shot by people protecting their homes. We go to a hospital just opened today after being shelled, where Iraqi students are volunteering and U.S. soldiers are providing some of the means to help a broken, blackened city back on its feet. But most important, we hear from the people. They are angry. They have no information, no papers, no radio, no TV, just rumors, some hopes of restitution, and still thoughts of revenge against a dictator who many feel abandoned them, who disappeared, leaving them to face a frightening future with no idea who will lead.
I'm Gail Harris in Boston. First, we'll hear this hour from Dick in Baghdad, and then later on we'll be talking about what's next on the Rogue Nation hit parade. After the war in Iraq, a lot of people in the Bush administration are saying the doctrine of preemptive deterrence, a policy of instilling fear and threatening force, is the best way to create global stability. And right now they are trading tough talk with Syria. We want to take your calls at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. But first, back to Baghdad. Dick, I want to hear about your day. I know you haven't gotten much sleep because you have been out and about. So what are you seeing and what are you hearing?
Well, Gail, let me start with the good news. We visited the Al-Yarmouk Hospital earlier today. It was evacuated last week because of shelling. In fact, there is still one large unexploded bomb stuck in the roof of the hospital. But so desperate are they to get these facilities opened again that there are now people in the emergency room. I met one young man wearing blue medical scrubs. His name is Saif Auf. And he told me about a boy who was shot at his own front door as he was waiting for something to happen on his street. And then he went on to describe his condition in good medical language. And I said to Saif, I said, are you a doctor? And this is what he told me.
Well, actually, I'm a student. I came here as a volunteer here.
Are you studying at the medical school?
Yes.
Just down the street?
Not this one. The one called the Medical City.
Oh, okay.
But my mom works here, and I came with her today.
Why did you decide to volunteer here?
Well, when I came here, I saw all my colleagues are here. They're all volunteered. So I decided to join them.
Do you think that this will happen more and more in Iraq, that people will feel safe to come out and begin to make the hospitals and the schools work?
Of course, it started already right now. You see, we wouldn't go out in the past few days, but now I think it's safer.
And will that make life better for people in Baghdad?
I think, of course.
Saif Auf also introduced me to one of the U.S. soldiers who was there. Their tanks were in front of the hospital, and the man that I met was slightly sweaty and slightly dirty, but smiling, and said he was from Charlotte, North Carolina. His name is Lieutenant John Teer. He's with Civil Affairs Special Operations 1st Airborne, and he was there to coordinate the team that was going to defuse the bomb, but also said that they were part of the other work to rebuild, getting the generators going. I asked Lieutenant Teer if he'd seen any change in the attitude, and this is what he said.
When we first rolled into the Baghdad region, I think that people were unsure about the change in the environment. People were reserved in their reaction to the U.S. forces. Over the last few days, the way they've greeted us has improved dramatically. You see the joy in their faces. They realize that we're here to stay and to help the Iraqi people, and that Saddam Hussein and his regime are gone for good. In addition, there was some looting at first when law and order broke down. Law and order seems to be restored to some degree. I think people are feeling safer to move about at night and also to get to work. Originally, they could not get out of their houses. They were scared to leave their houses. So the workers weren't going. The power wasn't being turned on. Hospitals weren't manned. But as the streets become safer, the people are getting out, returning to work, and we're here to facilitate getting Baghdad back on its feet and headed in the right direction as fast as possible.
Dick, I know you've been done a lot of walking around out on the streets. I wonder if it feels tense. And what are you hearing as you have conversations with the people who are also out?
Well, certainly as you're traveling around the city, you hear the sound of rifle fire in the distance. There were helicopters over this hotel this morning and some missiles fired in a neighborhood some ways distance. And just as we were beginning the program today, a couple of booms from outside. It could be munitions being exploded. It's so difficult to know in such a large area exactly what's happening. But back out on the streets, we stopped to check prices at a market in Al Dura. It's an area south of Baghdad. And we were just leaving in our truck when a man came running up to us and he thrust this piece of paper at me and he said, read this, read this. And it's actually been translated. It says, I'm asking you on the love of Jesus and on the love of Virgin Mary to help us to find our son who is just a civilian man. So I asked him what the story was. It turns out he has two sons and they were among those kids who were caught by Americans in Saddam's al-Jihad palace after it was bombed and abandoned. Now one of them got away and couldn't find out what was happening to the other one. So I said, well, what were your kids doing there? Were they looting? Why were they there? And this is what he answered me.
مجموعه كلهم شباب يعني
ليش راحوا
راحوا لو يشوفون لو يعني هاي
ما لهم علاقه لا بالسياسه لا بال
They are young, he says. They had no relation to the government or the authorities. They only wanted to see the palace from the inside and look around Just down the street, we drove a little bit further, and a woman called Amira Kothar Haddad invited us in for coffee. We were looking for another address at the time. And because she's in that South Baghdad neighborhood, she saw Iraqi soldiers running through the streets when the Americans advanced on Baghdad. She said they were fleeing from their trenches so quickly, some of them were only half-dressed. And she talked about the terror of the bombs and the looting, but what she was most concerned about is the total lack of order, the inability to find what's going on, no work, no money. But I asked her, I said, Saddam Hussein is gone. Isn't that a good thing? And her answer surprised me.
No. لا صدام حسين ما كان سيء صدام حسين مثال للرئيس مثال للإنسان الطيب الشهم المناضل.
We all loved our president, she said. He was a good man. He was a good leader. He was a good president. He's the only one who said no to America. We all liked him, but she went on, when the American troops came and overthrew Saddam Hussein, well, you, she said, pointing to me, you now have to help us elect someone who's better than him, not someone who would steal from us. And, you know, Gail, what was so surprising about that answer was that it threw me right back to a time when I was working in Russia and months after the fall of the Soviet Union, the people were actually saying, we'd sooner have the communists back in charge because what we had then was at least predictable. We didn't like it, but it was predictable and we knew how to make a life. And people here are finding their entire past 30 years has been torn apart, and it's impossible for them to know. There's absolutely no future. Those are her words. There is no future. Now, I have to come after that with another story, because on our way back into the center of the city, we came across another one of those huge statues of Saddam Hussein, this one by an Italian sculptor, and never mind who the subject of the sculpture itself is. It's considered to be quite a piece of art. It's in Al Zawra City Park in Baghdad. And apparently what happened yesterday is the Americans tried to blow the head off this statue with a tank shell. So it kind of tips now at an odd ankle, like he's cocking his head, listening. It looks a little strange. At the base of the statue, there were men who were unscrewing the big spotlights that used to light it up at night. I said, are you stealing these things? And a man called Mahadi insisted, no, 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 we're just taking them for the mosque. And I said, well, so what do you think of Saddam Hussein? What would you do if Saddam would be leader again? And his answer wasn't a pretty one.
أنا إذا لزمة أشرب من دمه ليش؟ قل له حرب إيران إيران ثمان سنوات.
I will catch him, he said. I will drink his blood. I was an Iraqi soldier for 8 years in the war with Iran back in the 1980s. He pulled up his shirt and showed me this great long scar. He said, this is a wound I got in the war. When I came out of that, I had nothing. I was hungry and poor, and I realized at that time that Saddam had just been getting richer and richer while his people were suffering. And I said, I asked him after that, I said, you would drink his blood? And he reached down with his arm and he scraped his arm across a broken part of the electrical fixture, making a great big scratch, drawing a little bit of blood on his arm. And then he put his forearm to his mouth and he started to make a sucking noise. And he said, yes, I will drink Saddam's blood. So, I mean, Gail, a remarkable contrast in what you're hearing.
It certainly is, Dick, and it's remarkable to be able to hear it firsthand from you. I want to ask you, you made the point that you had seen this transitional time before in Russia of where people took note of the fact that, well, at least dictators do make the trains run on time. They do provide an orderly and authoritative government. Do you see this as a transitional period?
The amazing thing, Gail, is that it has all happened so quickly. I mean, we're really only just a matter of days. And it was the speed of the collapse and the fact that nobody was expecting it to happen, not the Americans, but certainly not the Iraqis. And because there was so much fighting, the city itself was deserted. And as I said, people are just now beginning to come back out. We saw one man just standing in his shirt sleeves at an intersection directing traffic. Now, you need to know that the Iraqi drivers have always had an Iraqi policeman standing there telling them when to stop and telling them when to go. And without that policeman there, the driving was chaos. So somebody took it upon himself to do that. And what people were pointing out to me today was that this is starting to happen on a bit of an ad hoc basis.
Well, perhaps better that than nothing at all. Dick, there are a lot of people here who are anxious to talk to you. We want to go to our phone lines for just a moment, take a quick call from John, who's phoning in from Gonzales, Louisiana. Hi, John.
How are you?
Very well. Did you have a question for Dick?
Yes. What are they using for money to carry on commercial transactions?
John, they're still using the Iraqi dinar, curiously, with Saddam Hussein's picture on the Iraqi dinar. But the value of it has plummeted. It's the inflation is sort of 400% at this point. I note that in the few cases where Iraqis are being hired by the Americans to help with civil affairs, they're getting U.S. dollars in compensation for the work that they're doing. But, I mean, there's been no time to, you know, reorganize a new currency, and the Iraqi dinar is still what they're stuck with. They have many, many problems. This is a city where gasoline used to cost, in American terms, the equivalent of 3 cents a gallon, and now they can't even get it. They're driving outside the city to some of the filling stations outside to get it. But they're extremely worried because they feel that their own money set aside in anticipation of this time is going to disappear before there's anything to replace it.
Dick, you mentioned just a moment ago that there is no real news to be had, no newspapers being published. We just have a couple minutes before we have to take a break, but I'm wondering if that's increasing the frustration level that basically nobody seems to know what's going on.
I'll tell you, Gail, we had to hire a driver and hire a translator fixer to help us. And we got them in different parts of the city on the advice of other people. And watching them speak to them to each other in the front seat of the truck today as we were making our way around Baghdad, it was like, what have you heard? And what have you heard? And where do you think Saddam Hussein is? And I mean, it's any opportunity that people get together to exchange ideas or any information that they can use about the situation in their neighborhood. Some people have telephone service, and they can call within their neighborhood. There's no long-distance service here, of course, but it is quite remarkable when you think of a city of 5 million people with absolutely no means of publicly sharing information. That's something that people would really like to see brought back as quickly as possible.
Dick, we have just a second or two, but we want to mention to everybody that we're going to be hearing from you again live tomorrow, talking about some of the problems with the Iraqi antiquities.
We've had an opportunity to see the libraries and the museums. We'll be talking to some of the curators there about the problems that they're having, and hope to have someone live in the studio here to, or our sort of makeshift hotel room studio, to answer some questions. And we'll look forward to that, Gail.
Well, we greatly look forward to it. Stay safe, and we'll hear from you again tomorrow.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks, Dick. Connection listeners, we're taking a brief break, then we'll be back to talk more this hour about preemptive deterrence. This is The Connection on NPR. I'm Gail Harris, in for Dick Gordon, who we heard from just a moment ago, reporting from Baghdad. This is The Connection, frightening enemies and influencing dictators. According to the neoconservative doctrine of preemptive deterrence, it is better to be feared than liked. In the months preceding the war in Iraq, America forfeited the Congeniality Prize, but enemies were more angry than they were anxious. Then came the war in Iraq. Dictators everywhere saw their faces on the now famous Feld statue of Saddam Hussein. And when the Bush administration hinted that Syria might be the next candidate for regime change, rogues got worried. Proponents say that is the idea. But critics warn that no less than global stability is at stake. Connection listeners, do the neoconservatives have it right that fear and force are the right combination to use when dealing with rogue states? Or could the domino doctrine backfire, causing a widespread backlash against the United States? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we have two guests to guide us through the options in dealing with both sides of preemptive deterrence. Peter Husey is president of Geostrategic Analysis and senior defense associate at the National Defense University Foundation. He joins us from the studios of National Public Radio in Washington, D.C. Hi, Peter.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks. Glad you could join us.
Well, Gary Sick. Pleasure.
Gary Sick is also with us, and he is the acting director of the Middle East Institute at Columbia University. He served on the National Security Council under Presidents Ford, Carter, and Reagan. He's joining us from the studios of the Columbia Journalism School in New York City. Hello, Gary.
Hello.
I want to start with this notion that we just heard from Dick Gordon in Baghdad. Obviously, the shooting has almost stopped there. This is being viewed as a success, certainly within the Bush administration, and perhaps even as a model for other places. But let's back up just a little bit, because I think, Peter, before we can understand preemptive or preventive deterrence, we need to know what traditional deterrence has been defined so that we can perhaps draw a distinction there.
Let me. I went back and read the National Strategy to Combat Weapons of Mass Destruction, in which the Bush administration used the word preemption on page 3 of a 8-page report. Traditional deterrence is don't cross the border with tank armies across the Fulda Gap in Europe. And that was the Cold War. And we deterred the Russians with both conventional and nuclear forces. And the problem with terrorist groups, as I told your producer yesterday, is that terrorist groups don't have tank armies necessarily, and their state sponsors don't advertise their sponsorship of a lot of these terrorist groups. So traditional deterrence was more crossing borders, and it was state actors against state actors. But during the Cold War, starting with the terrorist groups in Europe and in the PLO and others, the Russians and the Soviets did make war on the United States and the West with terrorism. At the end of the Cold War, these folks didn't go away. In fact, many of them are still around. And we're still facing this problem of how to deal with folks who work in the shadows but have state sponsors. And I would say that the policy, if you go through the strategy paper released in December of 2002, there are 11 tools which they talk about in dealing with weapons of mass destruction, ballistic missiles, and terrorism. And they include traditional deterrence, defense, which is ballistic missile defense, like the Arrow or Patriot, interdiction, law enforcement and intelligence, mitigation.
Maybe just one more so we can bring Gary into it, too.
Okay. Diplomacy, threat reduction cooperation, like we're doing with Russia, export controls and sanctions. And any one of those can be done preemptively. You can diplomatically go arrest folks who are bad. You can also deal with export controls before an attack happens. And so preemption, about 90% of preemption would be non-military means. Iraq is probably the exception as opposed to the rule. And I would just conclude with Senator Wallace's famous dictum, which is diplomacy without the threat of force to back it up is prayer.
Well, Gary, what about that idea? If the notion is that countries that the United States doesn't like are now going to be frightened into silence or at least taking another look at their policies, anything wrong with that picture?
Well, the idea of preemption is not something new at all. It has been there. It is actually written into the United Nations Covenant, where Article 51 permits nations to act in their own defense when they're facing an imminent threat. So this is not something new. What is new is basically elevating that to a cardinal principle of foreign policy, where in the past this has in effect replaced deterrence and containment as a principal component of U.S. foreign policy. My problem with this is not the short term, because I think, in fact, it can work. I think it can defeat a country. It can certainly determine when. It can certainly intimidate other countries. I don't think there's any doubt that in the short term. I worry more about the long-term effects, because what's missing in this is the fact that the United States, then, as adopting a policy preemption, says that they are the judge, the jury, the executioner, and that basically the rules only apply to us.
As you say,
do we want the Indians, for instance, when they look at, across the way at Pakistan, to apply this same rule of preemption and say, I think these people are getting ready to hurt us, and so we have got to do something about it right now while we still can. If everybody in the world takes that attitude, we set the world back very far in terms of where we've come as an international civilization, actually.
But it certainly seems to be working, at least in the short term. I mean, we're now hearing from North Korea, which has been insisting for months about no bilateral talks only, and now suddenly they're very much in the mood for multilateral talks.
Force does, in fact, make a point, and I think the attack on Iraq has made a very strong point in the Middle East. I think a number of countries are, in fact, intimidated, and I think, as I say, I have no problem with this as a short-term strategy because I think in the short term it can, in fact, produce results. It's the longer-term results that I worry about much more, and I think very serious unintended consequences if every country in the world decides that preemption is the way to go.
Peter, let's hear from you. I know you've been wanting to get back in.
Let me respond by that. Let me read you the paragraph in question from page 3 of the December 2002 report.
Actually, can you just summarize it for us?
Yes, I can. It's only a sentence. U.S. military forces and appropriate civilian agencies must have the capability to defend against WMD armed adversaries, including in appropriate cases, through preemptive measures. Okay, so it is not been elevated to where it replaces deterrence. It's a complement to deterrence. And with respect to what we've done in Iraq and what we might do in Syria, let's go back and look at where we have used preemptive policies in the past. The Israeli strike on the reactor in Iraq in 1981 prevented Iraq from becoming a nuclear power, according to Richard Butler of UNSCOM. If you remember, in the Sudan, Bill Clinton wiped out an aspirin factory, so there's an example of something that doesn't work, shouldn't have been done, and one thing that was done that actually did work. So it isn't a question of every time you have a problem, you decide to either use military force or use preemption. You have to decide to do it over time. And I think with respect to Syria, you have a whole series of things you want Syria to do and a whole series of tools you have to help them. Why should Syria have the right to have invaded Lebanon and occupy the country, support Hezbollah and Hamas in southern Lebanon, that have 10,000 Iranian rockets between the ranges of 14 and 40 kilometers, plus the fact that the Syrians run the dope trade or heroin trade in that area, and at the same time they're interfering with the sovereignty of a government called Lebanon. I mean, we could just start with those examples. The Lebanese government doesn't need regime change. They don't have weapons of mass destruction. Israel withdrew from southern Lebanon 2 years ago, and the result was, Hezbollah says it's the only victory of the Arabs against the Israelis ever, and the result was the Intifada started in the West Bank and in Israel. So there was an example where Israel did the conciliatory thing, and it didn't work. It just emboldened our enemies.
Okay, Gary, is Syria the perfect test case?
Well, actually, of course, the reason that Syria is in Lebanon is because they preempted. They decided to go in when there was a potential threat to them, and they have been there in occupation ever since. Israel invaded southern Lebanon as a preemption because they thought that the PLO was building up. That turned into a nightmare for them, and they got out not just because they were being conciliatory and good guys, but because a tremendous number of Israelis were getting killed all the time, and they decided.
Then you should say that Syria should leave.
No, but I'm saying that preemption is a doctrine that, in fact, can be used by anybody to justify whatever it is they currently believe in.
Well, Gary, you can justify
the absence of the rules. And you know, the other thing is, your quotation, I don't have the document that I would have looked at to find out where preemption is in terms of U.S. doctrine, is the National Security Strategy of the United States, which was
Gary.
It was released on in September of 2002. This is on dealing with weapons of mass destruction, simply. So I draw your attention to that because the wording there with regard to preemption is quite different than the one that you quoted.
No, the whole point of the charging this is that the question of Iraq was its weapons of mass destruction, and in Syria it is also weapons of mass destruction. And so that is what we're talking about here. That is the real threat that 9/11 brought forward to us was, one, terrorists, that can have global reach and that might have weapons of mass destruction, which we can't wait around to be hit with. The fact that a bad policy is undertaken by Syria doesn't mean that a policy undertaken by the United States is bad.
All right.
Gary, you can't say that just because we can preemptively go arrest somebody in Afghanistan that is plotting an attack against us, would you say that that is wrong?
Quoting the policy, for instance, as being an appropriate point, appropriate, you do this. And who decides who is appropriate? The American.
The American government
decides that it's appropriate, just as the Syrians decided, just as the Israelis decided. And what I'm saying is there's a real cost associated with that. We have spent 50 years building a network of international institutions and rules that, in fact, are supposed to govern international behavior in a way to prevent this sort of law of the jungle approach.
It's not law of the jungle, right. Gary. Come on.
Okay.
Tell you what. Let me get in here just one sentence.
Okay. Very quickly,
The North Koreans, the Iraqis, and the Iranians signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. According to Mr. Baridi, who's head of the International Agency for Atomic Energy, all three have signed the deal in order to build nuclear weapons, which are prohibited by the treaties themselves. They've hid behind these international norms and these procedures to do exactly what they promised not to do, Gary. There's your wonderful rules of the road that these three states don't even abide by. And what you're telling me is, well, we'll just have to get them to agree to them. How do you do that without what we did in Iraq, or at least the threat of that? You have to be able to enforce these agreements. You can't just have paper on the table. Peace through parchment doesn't work.
Okay, Peter, we're going to hold the thought there one second. Because we have a lot of callers who want to get in on this discussion, too, not surprisingly. Let's go first to Frankfort, Kentucky, where Glenn is phoning in. Hi, Glenn.
Hi. Very interesting and exciting conversation here. I guess one of the things I think that this preemptive, and what we're really talking about is preemptive violence, preemptive war. It really seems like there's an assumption of both wisdom on the political leader's point of view and of a certain level of righteousness. And I think also I agree with the one gentleman. Somehow it seems like a quantum step backwards to have policies based on fear, because fear causes people to act irrationally. And one additional thing. Let's go to the first preemption that we did a couple of years ago in Afghanistan. Okay, that sounded like a good thing, preemptive violence there to solve that problem. But now why don't we have a policy of preemptive peace? Because now what we see is after we did that, we just sort of leave them there, and it seems to me from what I've been reading is that they're evolving backwards into being a problem area again, and what you're going to have to go in and use preemptive violence. So it seems like preemptive peace might be a better policy to take in the long term.
All right. Thank you so much for the call, Glenn. Mm-hmm. We appreciate it. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. Gary, I wonder if you'd be interested in responding to Glenn's comment.
Well, I basically share some of his views. I think the point that he made very strongly at the beginning is that there are certain assumptions built into this, which says that there's certain wisdom or righteousness in our position, which, as Americans, it's not difficult for us to believe that our government is righteous and wise in making its decisions. But, we have a government that is also, as we have seen in the past, capable of making some fairly severe mistakes. And it's the same logic applies to the preemptive deterrence as applies to, say, the death penalty. That if you make a mistake, the person's dead. And if you make a mistake in this case, you've gotten yourself into something, and there are no restraints. That's the part that bothers me about it.
First of all, we live in a democratic society in which our president and Congress make decisions on national security cooperatively, although there's often a lot of tension, which is where the system was set up to be. First of all, the idea that the United States can get a manual on any political or military situation and open it up and says, oh, that's what the UN says we can do, or that's what these rules say we can do. If Gary Sick has a problem understanding that the United States decisions, by and large, are motivated by not only sound motives, but with our allies, in this case we have over 50 allies in this effort, is that the UN unanimously Security Council said get rid of those weapons of mass destruction. We don't just do these things at the spur of the moment. We do them after careful thought. the idea that Saddam Hussein can invade Kuwait and say, well, that's preemption, and that's the same as us freeing the Iraqi people of this murderous dictator, means, Gary, that you can't make an independent judgment. We do that all the time. There are no perfect set of rules that in which you say North Korea and Iraq and Iran can play by the same games. They are committed to aggression. They are committed to overthrowing their neighbors. They are committed to totalitarianism. That is not what this country stands for. This is not what this country has ever stood for. I admitted right up front that when Bill Clinton bombed that aspirin factory in the Sudan, if you remember, that was a mistake and was wrong. But remember, he did that unilaterally without any UN sanctions. At least we went to the UN and got 18 resolutions that said disarm Saddam.
All right,
so
Gary,
we weren't
what
doing
about
this,
that?
We weren't doing this in a vacuum.
No, and as I say, I think that it works, actually. And as I say, in the short term, I think it really does work, and it has can be effective, and it's an effective tool. What worries me about it is the fact that this is now being placed at the center of American foreign policy, that this is what is being, which is replacing a whole set of doctrines that we had in operation for 50 years,
Gary,
largely based on containment and deterrence. And this is a new approach, and it is an approach that I would argue is dangerous in the long term because of the effects that it has. And I'm really concerned, quite seriously, that other countries that you may not think are so wise and that you may not think have the same kind of restraints, you know, we have seen India recently start basically praising this doctrine. They think that this is a really good thing. Why? Because they would like to apply the same thing to Pakistan. And I'm not sure that we really think that's a good idea.
All right, we're going to hold it there for right now. We need to take a quick break. We're talking about frightening enemies and influencing dictators this hour on The Connection, the doctrine of preemptive deterrence. Should the United States set its sights on other rogue regimes, or could that policy fire more unrest in the Middle East and elsewhere? You can join us when we get back. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris, and this is The Connection. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. We are discussing preemptive deterrence this hour with my guest, Peter Husey of the National Defense University and Gary Sick of Columbia University. Connection listeners, do the neoconservatives have it right that fear and force are the right combination when dealing with rogue states? Or could the domino doctrine backfire, causing a widespread backlash against the United States? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And let's go right now to Boston, Massachusetts, where David's on the line. Hello, David.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. Hey, my concern is that, I believe that fear is obviously, there's a place to use fear as a way of controlling something like a rogue state. But, we have this difficulty with the public relations side of the equation. And so as long as we continue to fail on the public relations side of the equation, we will fail to win the war against rogue states. And what I mean by that is that here we are, we convince ourselves here within the borders of the United States that we're doing the righteous thing, but we've failed to convince the world. And when you fail to convince the world, they have a tough time seeing the difference between what we consider to be deterrence and what they consider to be aggression. And my example on the foreign relations side, you know, when we think about why do all these bad guys want to do us so much harm, is that we fail in terms of consistency on foreign policy. The shining example probably being the one where we acted in Iraq under the auspices of a resolution from the United Nations. We took it in took matters into our own hands. But on the same token, there are plenty of resolutions that were passed by the United Nations specifically ones that were passed against Israel, that we take no such action on. And that confuses not only, I think, educated citizens of the United States about what our foreign policy is, but it confuses the world. And as long as we continue to lose the public relations war, we will have our efforts on the deterrence front will be greatly tainted.
All right, David, thank you so much for the call. Peter, I want to ask you to respond to David's point and also about what's different in a world in which it isn't just rogue governments that you need to worry about, it's also rogue groups that are operating within those governments.
Well, I think that if you go back to when did terrorism come home to America, when did we really see the first look at this, and it was the attack on our embassy in Tehran in 1979. And between 1979 and the 2001 World Trade Center bombing, our forces overseas, here at home and elsewhere, were victims of 24 major terrorist attacks, everything from Lockerbie to the Pan Am plane blowing up, the Beirut barracks, the Khobar towers, our embassies. In only two instances in 2001 in the World Trade Center did we go after the perpetrators, including their state sponsors in Afghanistan, and the Berlin disco bombing in 1983 when we went after Libya. In almost every other instance in Republican and Democratic administrations, we did very little. One of the tragedies is if countries and their sponsoring the terrorist groups get weapons of mass destruction, responding will be beside the point, unless they have other weapons they're holding in reserve and we can identify them. And when Gary says that we have elevated this to the top rung of our foreign policy and defense ladder, I would not only say you're wrong, Gary, because I had something to do with the formulation of this policy and know Bob Joseph who put it together at the National Security Council. It's one of 11 elements of traditional foreign policy as well as some new elements. But basically it says if we can find the weapons, find them. If we can interdict them, fine. If we can stop their production, fine. If we can get a multilateral agreement like the Non-Proliferation Treaty and enforce it, that can be done. But if the President of the United States sees that an attack with weapons of mass destruction may be imminent, and in fact he knows where those weapons are and can take them out or interdict them or stop them from being deployed, as well as having defenses, which is what missile defense is all about, was why Israel has arrow deployments all over the country. That, I think, is not only reasonable, but it's well within the tradition of American and foreign policy. Deterrence, traditional deterrence, didn't stop any of the terrorist attacks starting with the embassy in 79 in Tehran up to the World Trade Center. In fact,
okay, Peter,
some
you know
of
what?
The things...
Let's,
go ahead.
Let's bring
ahead,
Gary in because I do okay. want to hear him respond to this.
Sure.
He was around during a lot of this, and I wonder, Gary, if you agree that it was a mistake for the United States not to have responded more forcefully when some of these terrorist attacks happened.
The problem about a sort of direct response when something happens is that you have got to define the group that you're going after. And if you have a small rogue element within a government, as you did at the beginning as far as Iran was concerned, and you simply go in, there's nobody to bomb. And this is, it is a real problem. But let's go back to the point that David made originally, which is that the world is not going to be persuaded by us, and that they're going to see what we call deterrence as aggression. You know, I was really struck by the resignation letter of the Foreign Service officer who left the Foreign Service as we got into the Iraqi affair. And he said that basically he thought the United States was squandering the goodwill that it had built up over many, many years, and it was making his job as a diplomat impossible because we forget the degree to which people share our values, they think the way we do, they admire who we are, where we came from, what we stand for. And those values are tremendously important in giving us a sort of invisible leverage in getting our way. We don't always win. We don't always get our way. But we do very frequently. And that is due to the fact that people respect and admire us. If we undertake for ourselves the decision that we are going, we have now intervened forcefully in two countries in 18 months. And I think certainly the Afghan situation, there was no doubt. It was absolutely justified. Nobody in the world had any doubt about it. The case of Iraq, Peter mentioned, you know, when you know where the nuclear weapons are, an attack is imminent, that you have a right to intervene. I agree completely. I'm not entirely certain that that was true in the case of Iraq. We didn't see an imminent attack. We saw the potential of an attack at some point in the future, but we didn't see that. And I think a lot of the world found that very troubling, that we made the decision to go in essentially unilaterally as far as time and place, and that means that the rest of the world looks upon us in a different way than they did before. And I think we underestimate the price that we pay when we do that. I think there is a huge cost associated with it in terms of our ability to leverage the admiration that people have for us to actually accomplish what we want in the world. And I understand that after 9/11 we had to respond. I have no doubt about that at all. I just want to be sure I understand when we're going to decide that more interventions are actually going to hurt us rather than to help us.
All right, let's go back to our phone lines for a moment. We have Phil calling in from Newton, Massachusetts. Hello, Phil.
Hi. I just wanted to expand on the last caller's point about credibility and the way the rest of the world sees it as opposed to how we see it internally. And I would like to ask, particularly the caller that seems to be defending this preemptive strike, I'd like to ask him to frame for me exactly the differentiation between Oliver North and Osama bin Laden. We had essentially a U.S. government official who was engaged in gun running, money laundering, in contravention of a specific U.S. law prohibiting that activity, who funneled money to terrorists. They were clearly terrorists who killed 30,000 Nicaraguans. And what happened to him was that he got pardoned by Bush 41. Whereas bin Laden is hunted like
okay,
a dog.
Okay, we take your point, Phil. Tell you what, let's go with the main point you raised at the beginning, which was about the credibility issue at stake here. Peter?
Hi, Gail. I remember in 1979 when the President Carter actually ceded to the concerns of Congress and aided the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. I remember having dinner with an Indian diplomat, having lived in Gangapur in India when I was in college, and he said, "You folks are really serious about taking on the Soviets." And that became even more apparent in 1981 when President Reagan came into office. And let me go to the caller's point about Oliver North, which is, you know, beyond being outrageous, I'll answer it. When we supported the Contras, we did so with the express purpose of stopping the Sandinistas from supporting the rebels in El Salvador, where they were trying to overthrow the government. The Contras did not blow up bridges or buses or assassinate mayors or put landmines in coffee plantations, which is what the FMLN were doing in El Salvador. It actually worked. It forced the peace process to come forward with Contador, if you remember, and Oscar Arias, and elections which the Sandinistas tried to rig, didn't rig well enough, and we won. And it was the end of the FMLN as well a year later. So I think in terms of the NDU, I must read 1,000 pages of foreign editorials and stories a day about terrorism and weapons of mass destruction and missiles, and particularly on Iraq. And I find that when the United States does things correctly, like we did in Afghanistan and we did here in Iraq, people's views change, Gail. They really do. Now, it's going to take a long time. And I would emphasize again, no one is suggesting that every time we have a problem with either Syria or North Korea, that we use military force. I would argue that military force is probably 5 to 10% of the options, because often, as Gary says, you don't know who to strike, and even if you did, it might not do the job, and it's also dangerous. So I don't think it is a question of fear versus diplomacy. It's diplomacy and the fear of that deterrence brings to the table. And I think you've seen some, as you mentioned earlier in the show, North Korea finally agreeing to multilateral talks. You have Syria saying they will accept inspections to determine whether or not they have chemical weapons. And you have some very major changes in the PLO, a new prime minister, a head of finances from the IMF. And I think that's due to the fact that Israel did not abandon the West Bank because of the Intifada. They didn't knuckle under to terror. I think that says something.
You're listening to The Connection on NPR. So, Gary, let me go back to you for perhaps a few somewhat closing thoughts, because I'm wondering at this point, if the message now is that the United States is serious, is prepared to fight, is that a policy that's going to help make Americans safer, or, in your view, does it make the world even more uneasy and unpredictable?
I think it really depends on what happens from here, because, as I say, immediately after 9/11, I don't think anyone in the world doubted that the United States had been badly hurt and that they had a right to respond and they had a reason to go after the camps in Afghanistan. And I don't think anybody objected to that seriously. And so in that sense, I think preemption was perfectly justified and was understood by a lot of people. Iraq is a somewhat different case. And it is looked upon quite differently by people in the world than the Afghan case was. And then what happens after this? If this is it, you know, we've done Iraq, we've done Afghanistan, and now we find that we can use diplomacy and we can go back basically to a more multilateral approach to international politics, then I think this will be seen as a passing episode. What bothers me about it is that it's now being written into our doctrine as a permanent part of our foreign policy, which is quite different than we've had before. We've always practiced preemption. Whenever faced with an immediate threat, we have never put it in as a cardinal feature of our foreign policy. And I think this is something new, and I think it's really important for the American people to understand that this is new. It's not just business as usual. And we have to think about what the results of that are, the consequences, which could be serious.
Peter, a quick last word from you, if you can tell me in 20 seconds if you think the world's a safer place now or not.
Oh, I think it's safer. I agree with Gary that when you get serious, people respect you, and I think they'll listen well. I think in Iraq's case, remember the ceasefire agreement, the condition was disarmament. Saddam refused for 12 years, Gary. It wasn't as if we just woke up one day and said, well, we're going to disarm Saddam of his weapons of mass destruction. The UN said, do it, and he refused to do it. And I think that's the context in which you have to look at that.
We'll leave it there for now. We thank you both so much.
Thank you,
Gary Sick, Acting Director of the Middle East Institute at Columbia University. Thanks, Gary.
Thank you.
And also Peter Husey, who is Senior Defense Associate of the National Defense University Foundation and President of Geostrategic Analysis. Earlier, we spoke with Dick Gordon, reporting live from Baghdad, and he'll be back with us tomorrow. To continue the conversation, visit the forums at our website, www.theconnection.org. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Gail Harris, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.